Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where we have a catchphrase. Hey, a sound effect. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a critic of no renown whatsoever, and with me as always is my intelligent co-host, William. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic, and I, well, everyone calls me Bibbs. And you know what? Whitney is a wonderful critic. He is a super intelligent person. You. There's a reason he is my co-host. It's because I think he pushes me to become a better critic, and I think his high standards are sometimes a little much, but you know what? You know what? Someone's got to have them, doesn't it?
I was about to say.
Someone's got to have them.
If I don't have high standards, who will?
There you go. That's actually not a bad catchphrase. I'm critically acclaimed. If we don't have high standards, who will? That's not bad, actually. I like
that. I got a t-shirt with that one.
There you go. But yeah, so this is our movie review podcast over at the Critically Acclaimed Network. This is a weird episode.
This is a take two.
Yeah, we recorded this entire episode last Sunday night, and we recorded it. It was a long episode. We reviewed a whole bunch of movies. We reviewed the movies F9, Werewolves Within, Alansky, I Carry You With Me, An Unquiet Grave, False Positive, and The Sparks Brothers. And then, you know, I saved the file, I go to bed, I wake up first thing in the morning, getting ready to edit, put the podcast out, and I open the file, and there's no audio.
Oh, no.
I have no idea what I did. My theory is I was just... Look, as people who've listened to the podcast long enough probably know, I don't get a lot of sleep, like, to the point where it's probably a problem.
No, we are both incredibly sleep-deprived most of the time.
Yeah, Whitney works exceedingly late, and then he has to get up and take care of, you know, his family, his child, and everything. And I work my fingers to the bone on a lot of stuff, and I end up usually working until like 3 a.m. and then waking up at 7, and after a while you can't really do that anymore, especially in your late 30s, so...
You can do it, you start hallucinating, but
okay,
yeah.
You technically can't do it, but it's ill-advised, and it leads to the problem, so my theory is...
Here's my advice, develop a drug habit.
There you go, thanks.
That's good advice.
That is, we're not putting that on a t-shirt, and that is not the official stance of Critically Acclaimed.
I think they know I'm being sarcastic.
Just so we're clear. But anyway, my theory is I must have screwed something up when I was completely exhausted and falling asleep in my chair.
Or there was an MP3 elf
maybe.
Who stole it. And,
I mean,
you know,
my point is maybe I would have caught that sooner if I wasn't so exhausted. So in any case, we both got some sleep last night, and now we're doing this first thing in the morning for once. it's actually very difficult for us to work during the day just because of Whitney's schedule for the most part.
Yeah,
sometimes mine. So we're going to try to do that a little bit more often. Maybe we'll both be a little bit more alert, and that would be great for everybody.
Imagine we start recording like when we're not dog tired and our podcast really starts to suffer.
Yeah, people don't like us anymore? Wouldn't that be rough?
They like us because we're loopy and sleepy.
Oh my God. That's so sad.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and, well, I'm actually still a little tired. But let's go for it anyway.
We're never going to be 100%.
Well, what do you want to talk about first? Now that we're here and recording.
Yeah. I just want to say, so it might be a little weird, but that we're like... trying to cover material we've already covered before, and that might be a little weird for us, but hopefully for you it'll be fine. Let's start with the big one of the week. It is, to its credit, when the pandemic hit, F9, the ninth Fast and Furious movie, was just like, fuck it, we'll see you next summer. Like
Right away.
We're not pushing it back until like July. Like, we're not going to push back until October.
How many release dates did Tenet have? It's like...
It was a few. They kept
like,
pushing it
they
back
kept pushing
like a
it
month.
Back like yeah, a month.
They
and
kept
another
thinking
month,
like
and
Tenet
month.
Will be the thing that will bring people back to theaters, but they dramatically like jumped the gun on that. They just couldn't be. They just weren't patient at all. Bond has been pushed back multiple times, which had already been pushed back a couple of times, ironically, like before the pandemic. It got so close at the beginning of at the end of last year that they released the theme song, which they usually only do like 2 weeks before the movie comes out.
Uh-oh.
And now the movie still isn't out.
Still not out.
It's going to be like a year. It's absurd.
Black Widow is coming out in like a week and a half as of this recording, and that one was pushed back a bunch.
Yep. So F9, I just want to give...
F9 is finally out.
I just want to give them to their credit. They actually like weren't trying to rush it. They gave it a good amount of time, and it's paying off. They're doing okay in theaters. It's not like the money they would usually make. But this is exciting people, and people are talking about it. This is one of the most beloved franchises people have right now. It's gloriously stupid as a franchise. I actually, and here's where I have to admit to my shame, I wasn't able to see Fast 9.
Tsk, tsk.
I wasn't able to get out there. It was a combination of scheduling and money. And that is just going to have to be fine. Fortunately, we have Whitney Seibold here to talk about whether Fast 9 or Furious 9, or did they explain what the F is for this time?
No, it's just F9. That is the full title of the film.
F9.
On the posters, it's F9 colon The Fast Saga, which is the first time I've ever heard the series referred to as The Fast Saga, but... Fast Saga sounds like you're speed-reading Gilgamesh or something, but...
I had a big hat. That's all I remember about Gilgamesh. He had a big hat, right?
What?
Did he have like a big helmet? Like a big, a lot of horns or something?
You're probably thinking of Sauron from Lord of the Rings.
There's actually a Marvel Comics character called Gilgamesh the Forgotten One. He had this giant, helmet. I always thought it was funny.
I don't think that's from the story.
I assume they did their homework.
Good. So just remember the line, he had seen everything. That's the opening line of Gilgamesh.
And, okay.
You can sound smart if you quote that.
Nice.
F9 is nothing like Gilgamesh.
Dang it.
I apologize. Although I would love to see an ancient Sumerian Fast and Furious. F9, yeah. Is
just chariots flying off of cliffs.
There we go. In this one, boy howdy, this film is as dumb as a bag of hammers. It's really... kind of quaint that they assume I'm going to remember anything that happened in these previous movies.
Can I stop you right there and really interrogate the possibility of dumb as a bag of hammers? Because I put it to you this way. You've got a bunch of hammers. Where else are you supposed to put them? Well, is that really stupid?
It's not the bag that's the issue. It's that the hammers themselves are not smart. And if you have a lot of them together, they're extra less smart.
But you could say that about literally any inanimate object, really. Yeah, isn't it just kind of just being a dick at that point, the hammers?
Well, I've also heard, you know... Dumb as cheese. I've heard that one before.
Okay, well, at least you're spreading it around a little bit. Anyway, what happens in this one?
Oh, golly, a lot! Dom Toretto jumps a car off of a cliff and grabs a vine and swings the car like a Tarzan.
Wait a minute, does he grab the vine, like, with his arm? Like, just, no, like...
I think he, like, somehow entangles a vine around, like, the tail fin of the car.
Wait, it's an actual vine. It's not like a grappling hook.
It's like a rope. I don't think it's even a steel cable. It's like a crumbling rope bridge that it. It won't be able to carry the car.
Is he at least in like a DeLorean, like a car that weighs like 300 pounds or something?
No, he's just in a car. Michelle Rodriguez is in there with him.
Oh my god!
They say he swings it like a Tarzan. Another car jumps off of a cliff, and a magnet plane picks it up midair.
Ooh.
The magnet plane belongs to an evil, the son of an evil dictator who wants to take over the world, and he has hired...
actually taken over the world. We've hit that point. He wants to actually control it.
Well, what he wants to do is control all of the war machines, like all of the war computers in the world, and luckily there is a magical two-half MacGuffin.
Is he played by Matthew Broderick?
He's not played by Matthew Broderick.
Wouldn't it be great if it was, like, War Games?
But there's a magical soccer ball that if you unite the two halves, it's like a giant hacking chip and you can control all the computers in the world.
Thank you, computer. I know it's Wednesday.
The evil dictator has hired John Cena. I still don't know how to pronounce it.
If you don't watch wrestling, you don't know how to pronounce that name. I've heard people like, how do you not know how to pronounce John? And I'd be like, I don't hear it chanted very often. All I do is read it in the credits.
John McGillicuddy. who, as it turns out, is Dom Toretto's long-lost brother. And we actually get to see in flashbacks the young Dom and the young John Cena and how Dom got into prison to begin with at the beginning of the very first The Fast and the Furious.
Okay. Which they had articulated in the original Fast and Furious. He beat a guy up with, like, a wrench or something.
He beat a guy up and, I think, killed him with a wrench.
I think he was alive. He was just, like... he was just severely impaired.
Okay.
You know, he ruined the guy's life, is my understanding. Maybe I remember it wrong.
We learned why, and there's, like, a dramatic reason that has to do with his father, and we see all that in flashbacks. And now he has a rivalry with his brother, who has joined a super secret CIA-like organization of mercenaries that can be hired by dictators to do evil shit. And so it is up to Dom Toretto and Letty and Tyrese and Ludacris and all the rest to gather together and stop him.
I would like to...
And Han is back.
I'm glad Han is back. I want to talk about that in a second. I want to go back for a second. And again, you're explaining this to me. Here's the thing that I think is fascinating about the Fast and Furious movies. It didn't start here.
No.
It started with street racing. Remember when they were
actually...
There
was a Point Break knockoff at the
start. They were literally stealing DVD players off of trucks. Like, that's how big this got. Was in the original Fast and Furious.
It was petty theft.
It wasn't petty. It was grand larceny. But still, it was street-level crime. Imagine if we jumped to this. Like, imagine if... Like, Dom, you know, got away at the end, and, like, you know, Paul Walker was like, I'm compromised, whatever, and Jordana Brewster is just like, I don't know, college? Like, I don't know what they did. Like, but imagine, like, the second one, like, his brother, John Cena, comes back and says, I'm working for a secret CIA organization, and we're going to use magnets in cars, and we're going to take over the world by taking over that. And Dom Toretto's like, I steal DVD players.
I don't do that stuff yet.
You kind of want to ease me into this a little bit. But his brother was already out there doing that. So weird universe where, like, he was real small time once.
I do love the way this series has evolved. And I love that it has managed to grandfather in all of this goodwill.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter how insane these movies get. They're presented completely earnestly. And audiences love it. And you know what? I kind of loved it. I was enjoying myself. It is really stupid.
Yeah,
you talked about those magnets. There is a scene later in the movie where the bad guys have an electromagnet to cause, like, an electronics blackout. And the good guys steal it, and they break it up into little pieces and put it in the backs of their cars. And they have these knobs on the dashboards of their cars that they twist, and they can attract street lamps down to in front of other cars.
And poor kids with braces are flying from, like, a block away, like,
and they can repel cars away from them. Yeah. And there's a scene where they crank it, and, like, washing machines fly out through a storefront and bash into a truck.
Mm.
Motherfucking magnets. How do they work? It's very selective, these magnets. It's not like metal, all metal is attracted to them, just the things they need in the scene.
Right.
And yeah, so there's not a lot of, in terms of, like, physics or logic in these movies, and your brain functioning just starts to fail you after a while, trying to make sense of this. Human bones don't break. You pointed out that there's this really wonderful line of dialogue in the sixth Fast and the Furious movie, where Michelle Rodriguez is flying through the air, and Dom Toretto leaps from one car, grabs her midair, and they land on the hood of another car.
And we're talking, like a distance of, like, 50 feet, and she's thrown off at, like, 60 miles an hour. Like, this is not just, like, oh, a couple of feet. Like, no. This is a giant...
It's like two separate freeways on bridges and stuff. Yeah, it's like this insane stunt. And later in the movie, she approaches Dom Toretto and says very earnestly, how did you know there was going to be a car there to break our fall?
Yeah.
Because a car is like a soft mat you can land on.
Like, I could imagine if maybe, like, you fell off, like, a two-story building, the car is, like, on shocks and everything like that, so maybe the bounce would be a little better than just falling on the concrete. But we're talking about,
you'd,
like...
You'd still die.
Yeah, you'd still die. My point is this. Maybe that's a little better than just falling on concrete, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about being flung from a tank going at high speeds. And to a moving car. it's ridiculous.
There's a scene early in the movie when Michelle Rodriguez is on a motorcycle and she's knocked off by the evil local military. Don't ask. And she flies, like, again, 30 feet through the air, and Dom sees this and he speeds up. And rather than let her fall onto the soft forest floor, he catches her on the hood of the car.
Yeah.
She kind of, like, turns around and they give each other a thumbs up. Yeah,
they have plus 100 to cars.
Just logic immolates itself for your entertainment in this movie.
You told me there's a moment in this movie where the characters almost become self-aware.
There's a scene where Ludacris and Tyrese, who are sort of like the, if anything, the comic relief characters.
Yeah, they're a little distanced from, like, the main melodrama usually, so they're allowed to comment on it.
And Tyrese points out that they've gotten into all these really weird scrapes, and they've, you know, barely survived explosions, and they never have, like, a scratch or a bruise.
Yeah.
And so he posits the theory that they might be unbreakables.
Does he say unbreakables? Because that'd be a great thing to say.
They say invincible, but I think we might be invincible.
I wish he had said we're unbreakables.
We're unbreakables. You ever see that Bruce Willis movie?
They never made any sequels to that, right? No.
Nope. One kind of.
Yeah.
Okay, they made two.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, because you can be a really harsh critic when it comes to mainstream entertainment, especially action movies, I find.
It's not typically my beat.
I can appreciate that, and that's totally allowed, and I'm not going to judge you for that. I tend to be a little kinder to them, because I think I appreciate... I appreciate a three-star action movie, I think, more than you do. What is the line... that Fast and Furious crosses or doesn't cross that allows you to enjoy this, but not, for example, say, a Marvel movie of a similar scope and tone. Like, well, or something similar. Like, what is this franchise doing that allows you to give it a pass?
I think the great thing about this series is that it constantly goes for broke. It's kind of trying to outdo itself in terms of stunt and spectacular. There's something very pure about that entertainment. Why do we see movies with cars? We want to see cars do stunt stuff. And I know a lot of it is just special effects at this point, but it's still based in something very real world. I think the when you're going for like the superhero movies, their shtick is, we're going to do the same thing, but now more characters. Like, it's just a bunch of people doing the same stuff. There's a lot of special effects with, like, firing laser blasts and stuff. And that's, I don't know, less interesting to me.
So, like, when you're driving, like, I don't know, to, like, refill your prescription at the pharmacy.
Yeah, you can, like, pretend you're Dom Toretto.
Don't pretend too hard. No. I want to make that clear. I remember one time when I was, 10, 15 years ago now, when the game Katamari Damacy came out. You ever play that game?
I actually have, yeah.
Okay, so if you've never played Katamari Damacy,
you roll things up in a big ball. A
wonderful game. You play the Prince of All Space, and your dad is an emotionally unavailable asshole, and one day he gets drunk and destroys all the stars in the universe, and you are responsible for making the stars again by rolling up a whole bunch of stuff. So you're a little tiny, like a little tiny speck of a thing, like the size of like a thumbtack, and you just have a ball, like a big ball in front of you, like a dung beetle, and you're just rolling up things that are smaller than that ball until the ball is so big it can roll up bigger things. And initially you're rolling up things like, you know, I'm trying to think, like pennies and like crayons and things. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the game, you're rolling up literally whole continents. Mm-hmm. And it is spectacularly satisfying. And it's got a really, really fun soundtrack. It's a hoot. It's one of my favorite games of all time. However, I once made the mistake of buying the soundtrack to Katamari Damacy, back when you could do such a thing, and playing it in my car. And as you are driving, you want to, like, pick up smaller items. Like, I'm, like, driving to, like, go pick up my girlfriend. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Ooh, postbox.
just run into that mailbox.
Yeah.
Watch me roll it up.
Sometimes it's a little irresponsible. So you like this one.
It's difficult to say. Like, I enjoyed myself.
Had a
wonderful time.
Is that all it's going for, or are there salient themes?
Oh, goodness, no.
Okay. Good.
It sees a salient theme, and it runs headlong in the opposite direction.
Right. I have a couple of follow-up questions just for the sake of it. Again, we're not spoiling anything. We know from the trailers that Han comes back.
Yes.
And this is something that's bothered me since... Not Fast and Furious 7, because that one was basically the guy who killed Han is the bad guy. And I'm like, well, yeah. But by Fast and Furious 8, he's like having barbecues with people and shit. Like, everyone's sort of fine with him now. And I'm like, dude, he killed Han. Why the hell are we like having this gigantic sad send-off for Brian? And yeah, I know in real life Paul Walker died, and that's incredibly sad. Mm-hmm. But in universe, Brian goes off to retire. And to live with his wife and child on a tropical island and be happy forever. And they treat it like it's the saddest thing ever for the characters. And then Han dies. And then the next movie, they're having a beer with his killer. And like, it's like, isn't that a little... What did you have against Han? Like, isn't that kind of weird? So, I'm glad that they said that he's alive. Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes the curse off of that. And now I'm allowed to like Jason Statham's character. That's cool. I don't want you to ruin it for me, but do me a favor, just for my sake and the sake of you listening, is the explanation for why Han is alive A, addressed, and B, satisfying?
It's addressed.
Cool.
they explained the Kurt Russell character comes back, and we get to see him. Like, he's sort of like the puppet master. They call him Mr. Nobody, because he doesn't have a name, and he's been pulling the strings with this big, long, elaborate spy scenario of some kind, and he is involved in saving Han from that car crash. Turns out he didn't die.
Yeah,
even though we saw him, like, suffering in a crashed car, it turns out, like, that was somebody else,
or just,
that was
my knee. Dummy or something. It was fine, yeah.
We see in the middle of
that Tokyo Drift race. I guess they just switched him out for Super Smash.
Yeah, we see in the middle of the a flashback to Tokyo Drift, and Mr. Nobody's there watching the crash happen, and then we pull back, and Han is standing next to him, so it's like he wasn't in the car at all.
All right, fine.
So that's how they address that.
Well, I'm glad. They did.
And there's a little bit of a tease for the possibility of a Han and Shaw team up movie later on. So they get to confront each other about that.
I wouldn't complain about that. Okay. Well, all right. Well, I guess that's F9. I guess last thing, as far as this franchise goes, ranking it seems a little unnecessary, but. Is this upper echelon Fast and Furious, lower echelon, middle echelon?
It's the craziest one I've seen. I mean,
the craziest one. Well, that says a lot.
Yeah, I know.
Zombie cars in the last one.
Rained cars in the last one.
Yeah, like
Charlize Theron.
Artificially intelligent cars.
Evil hacker. Charlize Theron is back in this one, too. Yay. She ends up teaming up with John Cena and the evil dictator's son. We see her in this movie, and she's in like a Hannibal Lecter box, surrounded by this laser grid. Like, and she still has that stupid pageboy haircut.
Ah, bless her. That's awesome.
She's just sort of leaning back in her suit, saying, "Well, hello there." She's having the time of her life in this movie.
Oh my god, I love how much of an action star she's become. Like, she's such a badass. That's great. All right, cool. Well, let's move on.
But yeah, this one is. I mean, they can only up the ante, and at the end of this movie, they launch a car into space. So, yeah, I don't know where they can go after this, but I said that after the last one, too.
I'll tell you one thing that they don't have in Fast and Furious yet, unless I've been very much lied to about the plot. Werewolves. It is a franchise without werewolves.
Not yet.
So let's talk about a film called Werewolves Within.
Werewolves Within is a horror comedy based on a video game I am not at all familiar with.
Yeah, this is based off a video game called Werewolves Within. It is actually a VR game, and I don't have a VR system, so I couldn't play it if I wanted to. But it's my understanding that the game Werewolves Within is inspired by the party game Werewolf, or some people call it Mafia. Hmm. If you've never played this, you get a bunch of people in a room, and I'm going to just... The rules are a little bit more intricate than this.
It's sort of like heads up, seven up.
Yeah, everyone closes their eyes except for the person who's running the game. And then they say, whoever is the werewolf or whoever is the assassin, open your eyes. And that person who's been randomly selected by picking a thing out of a hat opens their eyes. And then they like point at someone. And that's the person who's going to be dead in the next match. And then everyone else closes their eyes again. And then the person who's like the detective can like point at someone and say, is that the werewolf or is that the assassin? And the person running the game can say yes or no, depending on whether or not it's true. And then
if you're wrong, you die.
Well, not right away necessarily. And then what happens, everyone opens their eyes and then people start accusing each other, usually based on nothing. Like, I heard some rustling to my left. Well, yeah, I had an itch. No, he's the werewolf. He's the werewolf.
My son is very fond of a game called Among Us, a little astronaut game, which is very similar. One person is what they call the imposter, and they can murder other people, and everybody else has to figure out who it is. And it's an online game, so nobody can see who
it's very fun. Killer. I like that game a lot, actually. So I've never played this game, but the idea of turning the werewolf party game, even just that, into a movie is actually pretty good, because the whole thing is it's about murder detection and paranoia. Awesome. Mm-hmm. So what we've got here is a new film that is about a forest ranger who moves into a small town. And the small town is full of kooky characters.
This is like in wooded Vermont.
Yeah. It's like, there's the weird, secluded hunter guy. There's the wacky postal lady. There's the woman who just wants to open an arts and crafts store and is weirdly obsessed with her dog and her husband who's, like, seriously trying to cheat on her, but no one will let him. Everyone's like, get away! The wacky person who runs the bed and breakfast.
It's the tweaker, drugged-out couple. The monkey wrench in this little community is the guy who wants to build a pipeline.
Yeah.
And he's building an oil pipeline through. Half of the people really welcome it because they think it's going to bring the community a lot of money.
Yeah.
And other people are protesting it. They don't want the pipeline to go.
Because they want to preserve the environment, and that's why they're here. And
this kind of tension is actually exploited by a potential werewolf in their midst.
Possibly. So, when people start being attacked by what seems to be a werewolf, and then there's a snowstorm and the roads get cut out, and then the power gets cut, everyone converges on the bed and breakfast, and the accusations begin in a sort of low-key Clue kind of way.
Hmm.
I'm going to say this right now. I love this movie.
It's really good.
This might be a new contender for the best movie based on a video game. Granted, that's a relatively low bar, but they are getting better. There have been some pretty good ones lately.
I liked Rampage.
Rampage is fun. Yeah. I thought Detective Pokemon was good for what it was. Mm. The new Tomb Raider is a 3.5-star action-y kind of thing. You know,
it's fine.
It's a good film. There have been some good ones. The best one, probably, if it's not this, is probably Professor Layton and the Eternal Diva.
Which is a kind of an obscure anime film that isn't really well-known in the United States.
It got a theatrical release when it came over here and then got swiftly forgotten, and it's hard to find now, but it's really good. Mm-hmm. This is charming as fuck.
Well, what it has is a little bit of naughty energy. A lot of the line readings are very flip. There's a lot of sort of throw-off gags. And I was getting a lot of, like, Joe Dante energy off of this.
Very much so.
In that there's a lot of horror, but it's very playful.
Yeah.
And so there's a werewolf stalking around. We see, like, claw marks and stuff. There's no shots of gore. I think it could have used that, maybe, but...
There's a little, but
there's
not
There's a little bit.
No, not... Yeah, probably could have been
there's, like,
been harsher.
Horror and violence, and everybody's really terrified, but they're also terrified in a really funny sort of way.
Agreed.
And... All of the broad character they're a little broad, but they read very well, and I think they play together very well.
Like, I believe the characters, the actors are all completely game for it. They're broadly drawn, again, in that Clue kind of way, where you put any two of them in a room together, and they'll say something funny. Mm. And that's what I want. It's got that great small-town community vibe, where you feel like this could have been a TV series or something, if you've been willing to pad out the werewolf attacks. The cast is great. The cast is completely game for everything. Sam Richardson stars as the Forest Ranger Finn, and his whole thing is he's a nice guy to a fault, but maybe that's actually not a fault at all, and I kind of appreciate that conversation. Milana Vayntrub plays the postal worker who's totally into Finn, but he ruins it. Because by being a dork,
he's a dork about his ex at an inopportune moment.
Very inopportune moment.
When they're about to sort of like really bond. The scene where we get to meet the two of them like just together for the first time. Mm. Like they meet out and they sort of wander around and she's introducing him to all the characters. Good screenwriting setup.
Yeah, it actually works.
She's actually he's going into town and has to meet everybody and she's on her mail route.
Yeah, so
not just introduce the characters that way?
In terms of like literally just walking around town pointing at people and telling you about them, it's actually really, really clever way to do it that feels really organic.
And then they settle at this, and this is a place I want to visit. It's just like an axe-throwing video arcade with like a juice bar in the back.
Yeah, it looks like a really cool place to hang out.
And like it's like a place where a Cameron Crowe film would be set. And
and
they just sort of hang out and they drink juice and listen to Ace of Base and converse. And they set up a lot of things that are going to come up later in the movie. And their chemistry together is great.
Yeah.
Like you can really sense just how much... Not just the chemistry they have together, but what great screen presence they have. And it makes me want to see more movies with them as leads.
Milana Vayntrub is a name you might not know, but she's probably best known as the spokesperson for AT&T right now. She has a lot of those, like someone comes into the AT&T thing like, hey, I have a funny AT&T thing to say. And she's just like, well, we got it. And he's like, oh, okay. And then she's like, haha, I am a commercial spokesperson. And that's... It's a weird gig, but it pays a lot. I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine Flo from Progressive probably is like a
billionaire
by now.
Yeah, she has mansions.
She must be set for life, and good for her. She's good at that.
Mm.
Milana Vayntrub, and I've seen her in other things too, and she's also a very talented actor. And I think this is maybe like the biggest thing I've ever seen Milana Vayntrub in as like a major character piece, apart from those commercials. She's great.
Mm.
I want to see her in things. I believe I had heard that they'd shot a pilot for a new Warriors or Great Lakes Avengers Marvel series.
Mm.
And she was cast as Squirrel Girl.
Oh, she'd be a good Squirrel Girl.
She'd be a perfect Squirrel Girl. And I want to see that pilot. Mm. Someone please send us that pilot. We won't tell.
We're discreet, except we talk all the time.
Yeah, well, we have a show in which we talk about shows that didn't get picked up and got canceled. But I would love to see that show. I really do. I'm particularly fond of Michaela Watkins in this film. She plays the woman who just wants to open a craft store and is like way too into her dog. She is really fucking funny in this movie. She reminds me of like a really hyper Mimi Rogers.
Like she has that energy.
Like you remember
her,
like from like if you imagine her in Ginger Snaps, like she's kind of like this, kind of chipper, maybe somewhat oblivious suburban mom type, but then when the chips are down, she's the first one to burn down her house. Like, that's this, but like this is like a 10. This is, she's really, really funny here.
I remember her from Britney Runs a Marathon.
Yeah, I've almost forgotten she was in that. That's a good movie, too. People should see that film. This is, yeah, I honestly just gotta tell you, please see this movie. I recommend this movie. This is the kind of film that I think if this had come out in the 80s, whether it had been a big movie or a small movie, by now it would have a big following. Yeah. By now it would, like, whether it was a hit at the time or it was sort of a blink and you'll miss it kind of thing, it would end up on home video. People would see it on home video. People would say, this is really great. And by now there would be like 2-disc special editions from Shout Factory and there'd be revival screenings at a midnight movie. And it worries me sometimes because this is, it's in theaters, but it's a very, very small release, that it's going to go to VOD. And it's so easy for the drops in the bucket now to get noticed because there's so many films that are not getting a major release and they're just getting thrown into, just thrown into the field, basically, just scattered to the wind. I want people to find this and I want people to appreciate just how much fun this is. Is it all-time classic? Probably not. Clue is better than this. I'm not going to pretend it's the next Clue, but it's got that vibe. And if you liked Clue, I think you will really enjoy this movie.
For sure.
And I think a lot of people like Clue. And I think a lot of people will really enjoy this movie.
Yeah, I haven't met anybody who dislikes Clue.
I know people who don't think it's a classic, but I've never heard anyone who said Clue sucks.
Clue.
Yeah. I think the worst thing you can say about Clue is that it takes a bit to get going, but by the time you're there, who cares? Well, it takes like 20 minutes for the mania to set in. But
I feel like it started as like this murder mystery, and then the filmmakers just got bored. No, it's a slapstick farce. We're just go right away.
Yeah,
we're just going there.
Yeah. Anyway, so Werewolves Within, great movie. I really, really enjoy it. Please check it out.
You know, I agree.
Yeah,
I really liked Werewolves Within.
Yeah, and thank you because you saw this before I did, and you sent me a text like, "See Werewolves Within, it's your jam," and I'm like, okay, because we can't see everything. And Whitney Squire saw several movies this week that I didn't, but another movie that we both saw. Is a film that has, again, fewer werewolves than I'd like. It's a film called Lansky.
Could benefit from some werewolves.
I think there are very few movies that couldn't benefit from some werewolves. Can you imagine, like, literally any movie, just throw in a werewolf, gets a little bit more interesting, right? Like, Patton. Patton would be great. All of a sudden, Rommel just wigs out. There you go.
You're a miserable werewolf. I read your book. It just said rawr.
There you go. Got a whole good bit there. Thank you very much. But yeah, let's talk about Lansky. Lansky is a new biopic about a notorious mafia kingpin, Meyer Lansky.
And a
real life figure, by the way. Mm-hmm. If you're not familiar with the history of the mafia, Meyer Lansky was a contemporary of people you've probably heard of, like Bugsy Siegel and Lucky Luciano. And he was instrumental into creating this underground, for a while some of it was legal, but this illegal gambling empire, international gambling empire.
If you're to believe the movie, it was Meyer Lansky who invented Las Vegas.
Well, the mafia kind of did invent Las Vegas, and he was instrumental to that. That's kind of true. It's a little simplified, but it's kind of true. He's also one of the only mobsters from that era to just make it to old age and die naturally. He got lung cancer and he died in like the late 70s, early 80s.
He was in his 80s and Harvey Keitel plays Lansky in the present day in the 1980s.
Good casting.
Harvey
Keitel's a great actor.
Harvey Keitel is great, and I've seen him sleepwalk through roles before, but this is not one. He's actually bringing a little something to this. He's
trying to bring some sort of a devilish yes, we're just hanging out at this Denny's, but I am telling you about how I killed all these guys. Yeah, there's a nice contrast to that.
He has some confidence about it. And unlike in The Irishman, there's no like sadness or introspection going on.
No, that's
he's just an old guy. He's like, yeah, and I did all these horrible things and I got away with it. No rules in the world. That would be, I guess, if it was sort of like a one-man play and he was just sort of telling you stories.
I would love to see that. If it was just Harvey Keitel, this movie would probably be great. But unfortunately, it's not just Harvey Keitel.
No, in fact, he has a co-lead in the form of Sam Worthington, who is playing a reporter who is a plank of wood. And
he's literally named David Stone. Like, I don't know, I don't know if there is a David Stone who wrote a book about Lansky. But when you see this movie and you realize just how kind of perfunctorily it treats the Meyer Lansky story, that one of the characters is named David Stone just feels kind of right. Sam Worthington, who you know from like Avatar, and that really good Australian crocodile movie Rogue. You know, everyone's still talking about it. It's actually a very good film.
He was in one of the bad Terminators. I know that doesn't narrow it down a lot.
But he plays an author who has been hired by Lansky to write his biography, to tell his side of things. And the book can only be published after Lansky dies. That's part of the agreement. So he's kind of free to be self-incriminating. And you would think that would be like this, oh man, we're going to get like all of these great insights from Meyer Lansky and he's really going to open up. And instead, unfortunately, the movie, which has a lot of flashbacks in which Lansky is played by John Magaro from First Cow, it's just a list of anecdotes. Mm. It's just a bunch of stuff that happened. And some of the anecdotes are more interesting than others. Mm. There's a part that I either didn't know or had forgotten about, because I'm actually interested in the history of the mafia. I think it's an interesting sort of chapter in American history, where Meyer Lansky and his contemporaries were actually enlisted by the U.S. government to help keep the New York docks secure during World War II, because all those ships are just in the harbor and it's potentially a gold mine for spies and saboteurs. So they were like helping the CIA or the FBI or whatever to keep America safe in World War II. That's a whole movie right there. That's a fun film. I want to see that film by itself. And there's a couple of chapters in this thing where I'm like, this could be a whole film and we could actually like really dig deep into the characters. But no, we have to skip along so quickly. Like, we cut from like Meyer Lansky, like meeting the woman who would become his first wife, played by Anna Sophia Robb. And then we cut to them being married, and then we cut to them having a kid, and then we cut to them, like, fighting, and then we cut to him being horrifically abusive, and, like, that's it. Mm. There's no sense of their relationship or what they meant to each other or
just
or anything.
She hates it. We just get to see her suffering. It's pretty awful.
Yeah, he's horrifically abusive. They kind of forget that he had a second wife until, like, at the end, and then they don't really talk about that at all. We get to see a lot of the machinations with him and other mafiosos, particularly his crony, as this film puts it, Bugsy Siegel, Ben Siegel. Bugsy Siegel is played in this film by an actor named David Cade, who I kind of like his approach to the character as like Meyer Lansky's like dumb hunky friend, like the guy who's just like he looks good, he looks good in his suit, and he has no potential whatsoever. He's not smart. He's not charismatic. He just likes to kill. And his greatest downfall, if you know the Bugsy story, is that he was around for so long and he knew Meyer Lansky so well that eventually he got promoted to middle management and he sucked at it. That's what it boiled down to. And there's this bit where David Cade, as Bugsy Siegel, is talking about how, like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm bad at this. Why did you put me in charge of Las Vegas? And, of course, it just leads to this ultimate tragedy. And, I don't know, something kind of fun about just seeing, like, Bugsy Siegel is, like, I don't know, almost like a surfer bro or something like that who just got, like, in way over his head. Like, it's like one of the characters from The Hills, like, had managed to, like, enter the mafia, like, kind of how they play Bugsy Siegel. And it's kind of a fun portrayal of Bugsy Siegel. I kind of like that.
But it's such a small part of the movie is the problem.
Yeah, exactly. It could have been the whole thing, that whole friendship. And that's the thing that's frustrating here, because I feel like they never really figure out what the heart of this movie is. They don't figure out like what relationship is most important. It ends up becoming too much about, in the end, this David Stone guy who I give no fucks about. Yeah, I didn't come to see Stone. I came to see Lansky.
It was the Won't You Be My Neighbor, or the Mr. Rogers movie.
No, it's Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yeah.
About the reporter and his relationship, but then they try to tie it in thematically because
he has like a problem with his dad.
Yeah, he has problems with his dad.
I appreciate
Mr. Rogers is about sort of healing relationships. Yeah. So
that one did it better than some, because at the very least the protagonist had something to learn over the course of the film. And I actually like that biopic. I think in that biopic he actually like There's a great scene where he gives Mr. Rogers shit, and there's a moment. There's a moment where Tom Hanks and Mr. Rogers looks at him, and it's like, you know that like there's a part of Mr. Rogers that wants to punch this guy right now. And he doesn't. He takes a moment, and then he says something thoughtful, and then he moves on. But it does challenge the image of Mr. Rogers just a smidge, and the protagonist of the film does at least have some reason to have these conversations. Here, David Stone doesn't have a character. He doesn't have a reason. He doesn't change.
He doesn't, and we spend too much time with him. It's not that he's, like, sort of writing this down or reporting back to a boss. We get to know his inner life and how he's divorced, and he's trying to maintain a relationship with his kid, and he meets this other woman and starts, but she might not be trustworthy, and then he's approached by the FBI because they know he's writing a book about Lansky, and the FBI is looking for this store of cash that Lansky might have somewhere, and he's just gonna die. And
what is it with this movie and Capone about, like, aging mafiosos, and all we're supposed to care about is where the money is hidden? I don't care. Are you gonna give me some of that money?
I was gonna say, if it was, like, not the FBI, but if it was, like, the Goonies. Like, it was just a group of little kids who are, like, looking for this missing cash.
Oh my god, that would be amazing. So, yeah. Like, Goodfellas, but they're little kids, and they're just trying to figure out where, like, Al Capone's money was hidden.
Yeah, but Al Capone is still alive, so they're, like, sneaking around Al Capone. Like, that kind of thing.
That's a fun movie. I would pay
that
movie.
That's a fun premise, but it's not. It's the feds. They're looking for, like, $300 million in cash, and that's a lot of money.
It is, especially at the time, but, like, fuck it, any time. That's a shit ton of money. Inflation, it's like even more now, but like,
right now, piff, I wouldn't wipe my nose on $300 million. Can't think of something I want to spend $300 million on.
I can't think of something you could spend $300 million on, like an
like
island?
A single item.
Yeah, like an island, maybe. I don't know.
A film, like a one big gigantic blockbuster. Yes, they cost like about that much these days.
Kind of I guess, fair enough.
I'd remake Avengers Endgame. There you go. Just to throw a monkey wrench into the system. This one's canon, too.
Yeah, and I'm going to get Richard Linklater to direct it, and he's got $20,000. Go.
No, he has all $300 million. He can do whatever he wants. Okay. Yeah. All right. Same cast. I'll get everybody back.
Okay. Fine. Anyway.
Or same script, but an all-new cast, and see what they do.
It's a real shame because, again, Harvey Keitel is really good casting for this kind of character. And you can tell he's really, really trying. He's massively let down by the screenplay, which gives him these, like, really shallow platitudes that sound kind of cool if you put them in a movie trailer but mean next to nothing. Like, here's a whole bit where, like, people called us the underworld. We were the overworld. And I'm like, wow, that doesn't mean anything.
What does that mean? Yeah.
You know, like,
The one that really made me chuckle was they're describing Bugsy Siegel. And just like, the only thing he liked better than killing was the dames. Or maybe it was the other way around. Well, so...
So he liked two things. Why don't you say he liked two things? Like, the only two things he liked, a surprise and fear. Fear and surprise.
He liked killing and his thermos.
But yeah, it's all these, like, big, giant, like, pronouncements. Like, in gambling, as in life, the only winner is the guy who runs the game. And I'm like... Deep, yeah, man. Like, I think you can gamble, like, twice before you figure that shit out. Like, it's not deep. He doesn't feel like Lansky has emerged at the end of his life with interesting insights.
Some kind of wisdom.
Even if, like, he had emerged with this weirdly creepy nihilistic view about life, that would have been interesting. And to have someone who is younger and maybe more naive, but maybe just more optimistic, challenge those ideals could have just been a good two-hander. But instead, no, he doesn't really have a lot to it. Like, you get the sense that, like, maybe he wishes he had more family, but you never really get a sense of profundity to that. There's nothing, honestly. It's a really frustrating film. Lansky has been portrayed in multiple films, usually in, like, an analog, because he was alive for a lot of it.
Notably in Godfather Part II.
Yeah, played by the great acting instructor Lee Strasberg. Who got an Academy Award nomination for playing Lansky. Lansky was still alive at the time and apparently called Lee Strasberg and said, good job. And I think he said maybe you could maybe be a bit more likable. or vice versa, I can't remember actually. But there's actually a film, if you really want to see a good, like, biopic of Lansky, it's not amazing, it's not top tier, it's not the greatest mafia movie ever, but it's good. There's a movie directed by John McNaughton, who also did Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. Starring Richard Dreyfuss as Meyer Lansky. It was an HBO movie in the late 90s. And it's quite good. It's better than this. So that's the Lansky. It's also called Lansky. So if you see a Lansky, make sure it's from the 90s. That's what I would recommend. Because this is a big missed opportunity. Such an interesting figure, you know, a horrific figure, but an interesting figure, and deserved a more interesting movie than this. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about some films that you saw and I didn't. Tell me about I Carry You With Me, which I assume is about cell phone service. It's about your
telephone. I Carry You With Me is a romance film. I Carry You With Me is directed by Heidi Ewing, who co-directed the film Jesus Camp. She's previously only done documentary films. This is her first narrative feature. And she made this inspired by two of her friends. Her friends are named Yvonne and Gerardo. And she knows their story about how back in the 1990s in Mexico, these two men fell deeply in love. And it's... She knows about sort of their struggle in their struggle with coming out, with being out in Mexico in the 1990s, and also about Yvonne's dream of coming to America and opening his own restaurant, which he would eventually do. And we get to see dramatized in those in flashbacks to the 1990s, where Yvonne is played by Armando Espitia, and Gerardo is played by Christian Vasquez, and how they have this really wonderful, very deep emotional bond as they've like met and fell in love. There's this really wonderful sequence where they meet in a gay bar and they talk about being in versus being out. They have all these light and deep conversations. It's very Linklater-ish for a few scenes, and they just sort of spend the night talking, and you know, sexual tension is rising. It's really, really wonderful, and. Then we sort of, at the end of the movie, we flash to the present, where Yvonne and Gerardo are now being played by themselves.
Okay.
It's still scripted, but now they're reenacting more recent dramas. And
Are they good as themselves? Do you think they were miscast?
Well, the director is very good at utilizing, both in the flashbacks and in the modern-day sequences, a very documentary-like naturalism. It's just sort of about living with them and feeling their emotions more than it is, you know, acting big scenes. A lot of the emotion comes from very incidental moments, little things where they're communicating non-verbally. It's very emotionally disarming, actually. This movie is kind of drifts around you like this warming haze, and you're sort of wrapped up in the love and the emotion and the draw of it all, to the point where we actually are missing vital parts of the narrative. When we flash forward, like, Yvonne is talking a lot about how he wants to come to America and he wants to open his own restaurant, and a lot of it is about how he first comes to America, how difficult it is for modern immigrants, especially during the Trump era and post-Trump era, where we're just trying to these people are just trying to survive, and how the system is like pushing them around in this really really unfair sort of way, and how he can't get Gerardo into America, and how they're separated for many, many years. And then we cut to the modern day sequences, and Gerardo is there, and we don't get to know the story about how he came in or how he assimilated at all. It's just, okay, and now everything's kind of okay. We're missing a big chunk of the story there, and that's a little dissatisfying. But I think the director is more interested in who these guys are now and how they sort of felt. She's interested in paying homage to buddies of hers. And I think she does a pretty good job. I think this is a movie more for her and for them and for all of the people who know them and if people have gone to the restaurant. It's like a little community movie than it is for something for broad consumption.
Does that value, right?
Definitely it does. I think, knowing a little tiny community is more universal than anything.
Yeah.
And I think she does a really good job of capturing these two guys' lives. As a narrative, it's a little bit shabby, but as like this sort of abstract emotional experience, it does carry some power.
Mm. Fair enough. All right. Well, let's move on. And you saw a horror movie.
I did.
Called The Evil Next Door, which I assume is about you.
Well, because I live next door.
We're neighbors.
And I'm evil?
Yes.
Am I evil?
Chaotic evil.
I'm chaotic evil. Yeah. Not even neutral evil.
I don't think we could have done it, but there was this temptation once when we were figuring out, like, people had asked us at the end of our podcast, like, could you, like, give a movie, like, a ranking, just because sometimes you talk about the bad and the good, and it's a little difficult to tell ultimately where you fall, when whether or not you liked the movie and recommended it or not. And we were like, okay, that seems fair, and we had a lot of debate over it, and there was a moment where we were seriously considering rating movies based on the, like, Dungeons and Dragons scale
moral alignment, like, for Dungeons and Dragons.
So like a 2-star movie would be like neutral, but if it was kind of it was like at least attempting some weird things, it'd be like chaotic neutral and like that kind of thing. I still think it's a fun idea, but I don't think we could do it because that's all copyrighted.
I think those are copyrighted, yeah.
Which is a shame because it's a fun idea. anyway.
Thank you for calling me chaotic evil.
Oh, I love you so much. You're at least chaotic neutral.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're very chaotic.
Can I be chaotic good?
Fine.
I'm definitely chaotic, anyway.
No, you're chaotic good. I love you, chaotic good.
You know what's not chaotic is The Evil Next Door.
Ooh, is that good?
No.
Is it chaotic good?
No. This is neutral. This is like, you know, if you have like a Geiger counter or a radiation reader and you point it at a block with no radiation, that's this movie. Okay. Like, there's no reading at all for this movie. It is a haunted house picture. It's a Swedish film, and a family moves into a house. Mm. The house next door is haunted with the ghost of a young boy, and the young boy in the movie makes friends with the ghost young boy, and the evil starts coming over to visit. And from there on, dad leaves town. It's just mom, son, and ghost in the house together, and a series of spooky stuff happens. And that's the movie. That's it. It takes a lot of the visual cues, especially the photography from the Conjuring universe movies, and that there's like a lot of dark blue shadow and, you know, long extended shots where people are creeping down a hallway and
everything's very moody.
Something will skitter past in the background out of focus when you're not really supposed to see it and you're kind of terrified by that. A lot of the usual visual ghosty gags that we've come to know from a decade of haunting movies, and this film brings nothing new to it. Aww. Not a thing. There are no new surprises. There are no new ideas. Some of the visuals are kind of interesting, but then you realize that a lot of it is just like kind of redoing, like, the spider walk sequence that was cut out of the Exorcist. And if you know The Exorcist, you've probably seen that sequence.
Well, ironically, it wasn't even in The Exorcist. It was in the version you've never seen. Yeah, and now it's considered part of The Exorcist. But I don't know if it is officially... Is the official Exorcist cut the director's cut now? Is that the one that comes out more often?
Not to me. Okay. When... I work at a movie theater, and whenever we want to book it, we have to specify.
Ah.
But if we want to get a new print, it's the version you've never seen.
Yeah, that's the one that's
Which is the newer cut, and which re-included the spider walk. The spider walk's cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
But it's edited into the movie awkwardly. So yeah. As a sequence by itself, it's really terrifying.
Yeah, certainly it's a hell of an image.
If you get like a special edition DVD, they'll include it like after the movie, and that's when you get to watch it. That's what The Evil Next Door does. There's a lot of people, like, bending over backwards and have scary faces. And, you know, scary, but, you know, in a way we've seen before. And if you've seen it before, it's not scary, is it?
Well, I think there's something to be said. And I didn't see this one, but I'm curious your take on this. There's something to be said for going back to basics once in a while in a genre. Because what happens
is... Well, just to see if it still works.
Yeah, so there's a template that has been struck, like, you know, the Friday the 13th Halloween slasher template. And then after a while, people are like, okay, but how do we do that with a twist? And then, okay, we'll do it, but he's killing you in your dreams, or it's a killer doll or something. And then every once in a while, I think it's useful to go back to the original formula and just try to be like, because it's easy to get lost and sort of remove what made the original thing effective in the first place because you haven't reinterrogated it in a while.
Yeah.
So I think it is possible to just do a straightforward haunted house story and just do it really, really well. And then have that be effective, and then say, it's not original, but it's really good. That's not this.
No, it's not original, and it's not very good. And I think because when it comes to haunted house stories, we've had those for centuries. Stories of ghosts, stories of hauntings. Yeah. Those go back as far as there have been humans. And, you know, this is when you get down to it, every haunted house story is going to be about something else. It's, you know, the ghost is representative of something.
Usually it's history.
usually it's history or since the 1980s, at the very least, tends to be about the dissolution of the family unit, the nuclear family.
Yeah.
That was something.
There's something in the family that is not being addressed.
Exactly.
Whether it's sometimes it's alcoholism or abuse.
It became really big in the 80s because I think we were reinterrogating the nuclear family unit from the 50s at that time. And
Poltergeist and The Shining were doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. Poltergeist and The Shining are prime examples of this.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is a movie that doesn't understand that about haunting movies. It thinks that ghosts are ghosts and they're monsters that move in with you. And this is about, you know, a divorce. There's a divorced family. So there's some sort of disconnect. Maybe this idea that the child is floating away from you and going over and grabbing a friend. But I feel like this film is not interrogating those ideas at all. I feel like it's much more eager to get to sort of the fright and the spooky moments than it is to get to any sort of the emotional state.
That sounds like
That said, the lead is very good.
Oh, okay.
The lead actress, let me look up her name. Her name is Dilan Gwynn.
Okay.
I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. Yeah, she is able to carry this in sort of a turn of the screw sort of way where she, you know, can modulate through a lot of emotions through just sort of creeping around a house being scared.
Mm.
But yeah, otherwise this is like baseline reading. This is like the structure on which you're going to put a good movie.
Right.
Like this is what we need to start to put the alterations on to make it interesting. And they never bother to put any alterations on it.
That sounds in some respects like the exact opposite of the movie I'm going to review, which is called An Unquiet Grave. And it's a film, it's a horror movie in which there's a lot of actual character work and actual thought that went into the underlying emotional and psychological reality of the horror.
Mm.
But the movie itself is actually kind of lacking in style, and I think that undermines it somewhat. This is a film, it's a new film on Shudder, and it is a two-hander. There's only two actors in the whole movie. And it's a really, really good, I will say this, although I don't think the movie is amazing, it's a really, really good example of how much you can do with no budget.
Okay.
Like this movie costs, you can tell it costs very little. It's two people, the woods, a car, a house, and a gravestone. Like, that's it. That's all you got. And they got a pretty good movie out of it. It's almost great, but they got a pretty good movie out of it. And the plot is this. 1 year ago, a man was in a car accident with his wife. He survived. She didn't. And he's completely traumatized by this. He's living with a lot of grief and guilt and shame. And it turns out that she had an identical twin.
Okay.
Who is also grieving. And everyone else in their lives is kind of ready to move on. And they are not. Yeah. They are still feeling this as deeply as ever before. And that's when he reveals that he has been doing some research and he thinks, and maybe it won't work, but he thinks he's found a way to bring her back from the dead, or at the very least see her again.
This always works out.
Always works out
really,
great.
Really well.
Every single time. When has this ever backfired?
Never.
Never. No, I was giving the listener an opportunity to interject.
Hmm.
Like, I'm sure you came up with one in that 2 seconds. Hmm. Yeah, because it's so common. But, you know, but that's the thing, is that grief is not necessarily always dictated by sort of rationality. Because if there was rationality, we go like, well, that's life, it's sad, whatever. Like, no, we're feeling things so bad, we're feeling the lack, and it leads people to do things that, you know, not necessarily in their best interest, but they feel right. You know, they feel like it feels good. Like, I remember when my dad died, it felt good to just sit on my couch and eat Cheetos. And like, that's it. I just couldn't do anything else because I was so sad. So if someone had offered me the opportunity to get to see your dad one more time, I would be very, very tempted because I missed him so much. And I think that's something that I think before I had someone like die who was really close to me in my life. And it was pretty old when someone really close to me died. In my life, I was very fortunate in that regard. But as a result, when I was like 30 or whatever, when my father died, I was completely blindsided by the emotional impact of that. I wasn't ready for it at all. It wasn't like, you know, I lost a close friend or something like that when I was a child. And, you know, I was able to get eased into that. And now I understand the process of grief. And so when it happens again, maybe I'll be a little bit, you know, more self-aware at that time or understanding of that process. And no, just a ton of bricks. So I kind of get it. And so this is the kind of movie that hits me better now than it would have when I was like 20. And I would have been like, this is illogical. Like, yeah, We're not thinking with that part of our brain right now. We're thinking with the emotional and needy part of our brain. So they both decide to, they have to go back to the place where she died. They have to do a creepy ritual. And that's when it backfires, but not in the way one of them was expecting. And that's kind of cool. It's a good little twist. And I actually really do think that it's pretty effective. And I don't want to ruin it for you because it's not like that many. Again, there's two people in a house for most of it. It's not like it's full of incident reversals. But I think that's actually got a good, almost campfire story kind of sequence of events. I like the overall path that the story takes. I think harsh lessons are learned. I think, you know, it deals with, you know, grief and regret and how when we're emotional, we do things that don't benefit us and hurt others. And the cast is quite good. In particular, I'm really fond of Christine Nyland, who also co-wrote this film. So she's excellent. The problem with this movie isn't the writing, which is fine. Isn't the acting, which is good. It's that it has no sense of style. Now, it could be that kind of perfunctory, matter-of-fact, almost hygiene film kind of thing. Yeah. Like, and that can be effective in itself because it creates this weird objective reality. And if you inject any horror into that, it can be really off-putting and terrifying. They didn't do that either. This just feels like, you know, if this movie had like the sort of a Mario Bava approach, where we're really gonna like
a lot of color and style,
a lot of style, exciting camera angles, whatever. Maybe not the whole thing. Maybe at least once the horror started, I think it would have sold the depth of the horror better than making it really matter of fact. Because what we're dealing with here is basically an allegory for grief, and the bigger you make that, I think, ironically, the more universal you'll make that. And it'll become something that is actually very potent. And I think they kind of shot themselves in the foot by not trying harder to make it more elaborate. The movie, weirdly enough, that I was thinking about when I was watching this, it's not a good movie, but it's a movie where, damn it, they tried, was Burt I. Gordon's Tormented. I'm probably the only person on a podcast to talk about that this week. Burt I. Gordon was a B-movie filmmaker.
Schlocketeer from the 50s.
And we talked about several of his films when we did the best movies MST3K ever did.
And I know about Burt I. Gordon because of Mystery Science Theater. Yeah. The amazing colossal. Same. A lot of giants in his movies.
Yeah, I think he's still alive, actually. He made a lot of sci-fi films about people who grow really big or people who shrink really, really small because it's a pretty cheap visual effect and you can get away with it. But he also did a movie that was about a guy who was getting ready to marry someone wealthy, and then his old girlfriend pops back and threatens to blackmail him. And then she, like, he doesn't kill her, but he lets her die.
Burt I. Gordon, 98 years old, still kicking.
Still kicking around. He doesn't kill her, but she's, like, about to fall off of a lighthouse, and he decides not to save her. And then for the rest of the movie, as everyone else is, like, all happy and getting ready for this wedding, he is tormented by the ghost of this woman that he killed. And Burt I. Gordon is, you know, he likes to think of himself as a visual effects maestro, and he throws in all kinds of, like,
he likes to think of himself as an effects guy.
I will say this. Sometimes he gets away with it, sometimes he doesn't, but you can tell whenever Burt I. Gordon makes a movie, he's doing it because he likes the visual effects. And he doesn't always have the money for it. So sometimes they look cool, sometimes they don't. This one's got, like, a lot of, like, floating heads and stuff like that. But I feel like the attempt at virtuosity in Tormented... I like the movie Virtuosity, too. but I feel like the attempt at being virtuosic. Is that a word?
Virtuosic, sure.
Okay.
Being a virtuoso.
Yeah, the attempt at that would have worked really, really well if, like, the writing and the acting had been good and Tormented. And it's not. If you had taken that kind of approach to something like An Unquiet Grave and actually, like... And again, it doesn't need to be Sam Raimi-esque and crazy, but you just make it, like, spooky... You could have had something that was really potent and really hit really, really hard. And instead, you got something that just feels, like, muted to a fault. Yeah. However, again, I do say this. It's quite good. Maybe not amazing, but it is quite good. And if you're thinking to yourself, man, how do I make a very low-budget movie that tells a complete story with next to nothing? This is a great example. You can totally do it. You just got to think yourself, you got to come up with a story that doesn't need a lot. Mm. And this is a good story. Just could have been told better.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Tell me about False Positive while we're talking about horror movies.
Okay, False Positive is another horror movie. It's Done. More it's more of a pregnancy thriller than it is a pregnancy horror movie. Mm. But this is written by, it was directed by John Lee. It was written by John Lee and Alana Glazer, who also stars. These are comedians. They're known for shows like Broad City. A lot of comedy shows I don't actually watch, but
okay. Broad City is quite good.
It's made by comedians. And, they are, there's no comedy here at all, though. They're really interested in exploring, the world of pregnancy. Alana Glazer plays a woman who, the world of pregnancy, the industry of pregnancy, the wonderful world of pregnancy, the pregnancy industry, and they're criticizing the pregnancy industry. Alana Glazer plays a woman who has been taking fertility drugs, so she and her husband, who's played by Justin Theroux, can get pregnant. Thanks to connections he has, he was the former student of this well-known professor, played by Pierce Brosnan. He's now a fertility doctor, and they go to him. He's really exclusive, and through his machinations, she's able to get pregnant. And there are twists along the way about the pregnancy, but more than anything, it's about how she is being treated through all these machinations. She's having a lot of really dark visions. She starts hallucinating like puddles of blood, or finds herself in like these big glowing red fields. And there's a lot of horror just through these like shots and the atmosphere. And of course, the music does a lot of the heavy lifting. There's a lot of just really screechy, weird, spooky stuff going on the soundtrack. But more than anything, she feels a lot of really horrendous condescension, not just from her husband, not just from Pierce Brosnan, but from the world in general. All of this language we use around pregnant women is incredibly condescending. This, you're glowing, or if you forget something, you just have mommy brain. And that's a phrase that's used a lot in this movie, is, oh, you just have mommy brain. And this movie is using mommy brain as a way of gaslighting her. I told you this. No, you didn't tell me that. Oh, you just have mommy brain. You forgot about that because you're pregnant. And like I said, there are some twists with the pregnancy, but she begins to suspect some really horrible things are going on with her body, that her the men in her life are not telling her about. She begins to suspect some weird conspiracy. She even has a dream where her husband and Pierce Brosnan are having an affair. And it continues apace, and it eventually climaxes in like the sort of grindhouse B-movie climax, and I won't spoil it. I'll say this, that Alana Glazer is very, very good, and she is capturing something really, really palpable and real about kind of the treacly language connected to the birthing industry. If any of you have kids, you probably know what I'm talking about how you are treated so much differently during pregnancy. This is something my wife and I went through, and how there's so much language out there, not necessarily directly from your doctors, but just in general, about this glowing, blissful time that pregnancy is supposed to be, and how there's all these mysteries that people they seem like they're hiding stuff from you, and all these pregnancies are different, and everybody's the same, or this is normal, this is not normal. It's all this very fraught, dramatic time, all geared around essentially industry. They're trying to sell you a lot of this stuff. And I think Alana Glazer is really, really good at criticizing that kind of language, because it's something I've been through. I can recognize it. Gretchen Mol is in this movie.
Yay!
She plays the nurse at Pierce Brosnan's clinic, and she plays it like a Stepford nurse, like she's kind of robotic. She's great.
She's really underappreciated.
Yeah, Gretchen Mol is like she's hilarious in this movie, but also really terrifying.
Yeah,
and yeah, she has a really wonderful sequence near the end of the movie, which sadly I can't talk about. But yeah, I think she. Is really, really underrated actress. She never really... She got to lead a couple movies. She was in a romance in the 1990s with Jude Law.
Oh, where he was he did that thing where you make art with like little pieces of rocks.
I think so. It was called Music from Another Room.
Yeah, that's a weird film. Mm-hmm. But
it's a bit odd, but I think she was really good in it. She I guess her biggest starring
mosaics.
Role.
He makes mosaics. Mosaic. That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
Little rocks.
What?
And
what do you do?
Tiles, please. She was also,
tile,
also the lead in the. She played Betty Page in a Betty Page biopic, and she was really good in that as
she
well.
She was in Rounders. She had a moment where it seemed like she was really going to break out, and it didn't happen. And it's always unfortunate to see that. And you know, but anyway, she's great. And seriously, someone give her like a cool. Like
give her a statue of some kind.
Give her like a Tarantino-esque role. Like give her something like all of a sudden people are like she's like, has been great forever, hasn't she? Like
cast her in some like really wild, difficult role, but yeah. She's capable of it. So yeah, just like, for some praise,
yeah. Give her everybody. I just like Gretchen Mol anyway.
She only has a supporting role in this one, but she's really, really good. And Alana Glazer is really good. And Pierce Brosnan is, I think he's really good as. He was a good choice back in the 90s to play James Bond, because I think James Bond is kind of a smarmy character.
Oh, he was perfect
and
Bond. He was a great Bond.
He's my favorite James Bond. I know that's a controversial take, but...
I see it. Honestly, yeah. His movies were like hit and miss. I think they did like 1.5 really good ones.
I think the first two he did were really good. The second... Yeah. The third one was... and the fourth one was just awful, but I think he's good in the role.
Yeah.
Because he has that smarminess, and here he does have that... condescending smarminess of this old doctor, oh, I know better than you, kind of energy.
That's what he's always been good at. And I feel like, I think my favorite Pierce Brosnan role is actually, you ever see The Tailor of Panama?
Oh, I saw that one, yeah.
That movie's great. Where, like, Pierce Brosnan is, like, the spy who, like, hooks up with this tailor who, like, does, like, fancy clothes for, like, the biggest people in the country and just ends up... He's a spy, but he's, like, a shitty, like, evil spy who just manipulates everyone and doesn't care if the information is true or not. And, boy, is that a great counterpoint to his Bond movies. It feels like he was actually trying to make a point. I really do. I love that film so much.
I'll have to watch that one again, but yeah.
Yeah, it's been a bit. John Borman did that, right, I think?
Did he?
I think it was John Borman.
I forgot who did the Taylor.
I will look it up.
I just lost a Schmodown question.
Taylor of Panama.
Taylor of Panama, director.
There you go.
What would you like to talk about next?
John Borman.
Would you like me to talk about the Sparks Brothers?
Do we have anything else? I thought it was just the Sparks Brothers.
I guess that's it. Okay.
Yeah, please, talk about the Sparks Brothers then. Otherwise, we're stuck.
The Sparks Brothers. And then the podcast never ends.
And then we just start back on with F9. I didn't see F9. Tell me how it was.
Probably do that. We should do like a marathon, just reviewing the same movie over and over again.
Nice.
The Sparks Brothers is the latest documentary from Edgar Wright, who is a canonized geek filmmaker who burst onto the scene with very energetic genre pictures like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz.
Certainly speaking, he burst onto the scene with the TV series Spaced, which set the template for those movies everyone liked.
I guess in the United States, Spaced was sort of a cult phenomenon here. Yeah.
I remember when I was like in the early 2000s, like Spaced wasn't available in America. It never aired in America. Mm. It wasn't released on home video in America. But if you went into a comic book store, the person behind the counter did have a bootleg tape, and you could get a bootleg tape of Spaced, and it was like this cool thing that nobody knew about.
That Edgar Wright's listening. He's gonna ask for his royalties.
I bought the DVD.
You're calling out all of those comic book owners.
Edgar. When it came out, I bought the DVD. I know you're listening.
I would like to think Edgar Wright would be like kind of okay with his show being distributed in the States like underground now.
Yeah,
like at the time he'd probably be a little miffed,
but it wasn't available
money,
here,
but,
it was generating interest so that people demanded it, and then it came out and helped his career. I think it worked out, but anyway.
But if there's
keep
anything
circulating the tapes,
if there's anything you know about Edgar Wright, it's that he's a fanboy. He makes movies that look like the movies he likes. He made a movie called Baby Driver. It's just because he's a big fan of the movie The Driver and wanted to do a movie like that.
Shaun of the Dead is every zombie movie he ever liked. Hot Fuzz is every cop movie ever liked.
That's a legit approach to making movies.
He brings his own material and his own take and his own thoughts to those films. And Shaun of the Dead took all those zombie movies and told a really human story about, the last phase of growing up, where you're an adult and you're kind of clinging to your childhood, and now you have something happens, an emergency, and you have to actually find your inner strength. It's zombies.
Shaun of the Dead, and I think The World's End make good sort of bookends to one another, because I think The World's End is the one with it kind of criticizes that kind of thinking. Yeah. Like he's actually a little bit, I think that movie's a little bit more introspective.
It's a really good film. It's underappreciated. Yeah. I think Hot Fuzz is great too. I think that trilogy is fantastic. Yeah.
I'm on record. I'm not so fond of his Scott Pilgrim. I'm not so fond of Baby Driver. But my point being is that he likes to devote himself to his objects of affection.
Yeah.
He is a big fan of the band Sparks, which got their start in the late 70s and has been making music incredibly prolifically ever since then. And as such, he's made of this very large, incredibly long and informative love letter about the band Sparks. The band Sparks is essentially the brothers Ron and Russell Mael, M-A-E-L, who are local to Los Angeles. There's photographs of them from their childhood, and they're hanging out in Santa Monica and places where I hung out in my childhood. They went to UCLA. They decided to form a band in the 1970s with some other guys at UCLA called Half Nelson. They played a couple gigs. They got a couple gigs in England. At one point in their career, somebody said, look, Half Nelson isn't working. That's not a good band name. I think it's a fine band name, but they said they need a new change.
Mm. So we're just going to go with Nelson.
Well,
no halves. We got to go full board. Just full Nelson. Surely
there's a band out there just called Nelson. But
I'm sure there is. It's probably a band called Everything by Now. Yeah. In the dictionary.
You know, one of my favorites is still the Jehovah's Witness Protection Program.
That's good.
But one of the it was a producer of theirs. I think it might have been Todd Rundgren. Pulled them aside and said, hey, I know you guys are into like really old, funny comedy movies. Why don't, you guys like the Marx Brothers? Why don't we call you the Sparks Brothers? And they looked at each other and said, how about just Sparks? And that was the name of their band from then on. But Edgar Wright, knowing that little piece of trivia, cutely named his film, the Sparks Brothers.
I get it.
and Edgar Wright loves to be cute. He gets two of the members of Duran Duran on camera to talk about Sparks, and they're on camera, and each one of them has one Duran under their name. This is Duran, and, like, that's the two guys. And you got them together, and they're Duran Duran.
Mm.
Isn't that cute? Weird Al Yankovic appears in the movie. His chyron is accordion player.
Cute.
Which I think Weird Al has done before. I think he likes to be described as accordion player. And he puts himself on camera, which seems incredibly self-indulgent to me.
What's the line between putting yourself on camera and narrating your own documentary like Werner Herzog does? Is it really that big a difference?
Well, if you've already constructed it as a Talking Heads documentary and you're getting information from all of these recognizable or famous people, putting yourself on camera seems indulgent at that point. Because he's not really, he does narrate a little bit, but then he gets on camera. Like, he's getting a little too involved in the Sparks story. But I said this is a very informative documentary, and if there's anything you don't know about Sparks, you're going to know it all by the end. Because Edgar Wright takes kind of a Wikipedia page entry to this movie. He doesn't really bookend it. He doesn't set any sort of context. He just goes through chronologically, album by album, what was going on in Sparks' career at the time. Now, Rom and Russell Mael are the only consistent members of Sparks, and they do all of the writing and singing, and all of the other band members kind of rotated through. They had drummers for several records at a time, maybe, but for the most part, they had a different lineup on every record, so all of their records sound a little different. And as such, that I guess Edgar Wright felt this was a good way to sort of go through their discography. How many records do they have? A lot. They have 25 records.
It's like every other year. They've been active for 50 years now.
That's crazy. Yeah, just about every other year. And they talk about some of their failed projects as well. There's a little bit of talk about how they wanted to adapt a famous manga. It's called like Miri the Psychic Girl, or I forgot the actual name of it.
I didn't know that.
They wanted to make a musical of this manga that they were big fans of, and indeed Tim Burton signed on to direct this movie. And then through, you know, the machinations of fate,
The Psychic Girl. I'm unfamiliar with, actually. Interesting.
They really liked it, and they wanted to make, like, when they couldn't get records made, they decided to make this movie, and that kind of burned them, and they were a little upset. They're also in the movie Roller Coaster. They're in it. A Roller Coaster was made like right at the tail end of that disaster trend of the 1970s.
Where they were running out of stuff to be a disaster.
And the ride Revolution had just opened up at Six Flags Magic Mountain here in Southern California, which is really quaint now, but it's still there. I think it's their older, I guess, like two of the coasters they built in like the 70s or 80s.
Mm.
They're still standing. And at the end, the bad guy gets hit by the roller coaster and there's a bomb on it. I saw it on TV. It sucks.
Is it playing the real roller coaster, or is it playing like an alternate version of that roller coaster?
I think it's the real version. I think it's called Revolution in the movie.
It always amuses me when real theme parks will allow their brand. I understand a lot of people to shoot there, but allow their branding to be associated with something that where the theme park isn't safe, like SeaWorld and Jaws 3D.
Yeah,
it's just SeaWorld. It's not like Ocean World. It's SeaWorld. And it shows them being shitty and abusive and unsafe and getting all of their people and getting all of their audience killed.
Yeah.
How was SeaWorld okay with that?
Well, if you've seen the documentary Blackfish, you know that was just pretty accurate.
Yeah, SeaWorld was just like, well, we got off light. Let's do this.
Seriously.
Jesus Christ.
But yeah, they're in the movie roller coaster. They hire a band to open up the roller coaster and there's Sparks. Sparks had a few charting hits. They were never gigantic. They did a track called Cool Places. That was one of the ones I was familiar with. They did another track called I Predict. That was another one I was familiar with, but that's because I've been delving through a lot of new wave stuff.
A lot of Sparks. I was actually relatively unfamiliar with Sparks until I became familiar with the inner workings of my wife and partner M. Lopez da Silva's iPod. Which has just been in our car for forever. It's she has a lot of Sparks. So I've listened to a lot of Sparks.
Okay.
Sparks rules. I didn't see this documentary, but Sparks rules. Sparks is a good band. And if you're unfamiliar with Sparks, listen to some Sparks. They're really good.
I kind of wish that Edgar Wright had more than just praise. He was actually trying to tell a broader story about Sparks.
Because it sounds like it's a fan documentary.
It's just a fan documentary. Here's why we love this. We love this. And it's, person after person. They got a lot of famous people. I mentioned Weird Al, but Neil Gaiman and Michael Myers and Duran Duran and Roddy Bottom from Faith No More. And a lot of musicians are in this movie.
Yeah.
A lot of producers are in this movie. They get Giorgio Moroder produced one of their records. Todd Rundgren produced one of their records way back in the early days.
I hear Bjork is in it.
Bjork's, they didn't get her on camera, but her voice is in it. And they got Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, who have both made several films with Edgar Wright, to come in and do some voice work and some animated sequences. There's a funny animated bit because Sparks was really striking. Their music is actually really kind of playful. There's a sense of humor to their music, a kind of cynicism. That's, they argue in this documentary, kept them out of the mainstream. They're a little bit too cheeky for their own good. Russell is sort of seen as the pretty boy of the group. He was the lead singer. He has a really interesting voice. A lot of people tuned in just because he was so good looking. Whereas Ron, he played keyboard. He didn't sing. He looks a little bit like David Byrne, but he adopted the costume of Adolf Hitler early on in their career, in the sort of confrontational, cheeky, playful, funny kind of way. It's like, oh, look, here's the band member, and he looks a lot like Hitler. So he had the little mustache and the combed down hair, and he always had this kind of serious expression on his face. He was playing a role on stage. And they were such a unique look that other famous musicians kind of recognized them. And there were, as such, Paul McCartney dressed up as Ron Mayall in a music video of his for some Paul McCartney work. So they have this animated sequence where they're trying to imagine what it would have been like for the Beatles to be hanging out talking about Sparks in the 1970s. DJ Lance Rock is in the movie. Jane Wiedlin is in it. She was the one who sings, on Cool Places. Fred Armisen, Flea, Patton Oswalt, anybody you can think, anybody.
Patton Oswalt. Are you talking about something cool? Patton Oswalt's in your documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just shows up. Hey, I hear you're talking about G.I. Joe the movie. I have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah. Make a documentary about G.I. Joe the movie.
I have 5 minutes on Sergeant Slaughter playing himself and how that really wrecks the universe.
5 minutes. He could go on for 50.
I know.
On Sergeant Slaughter.
I love Ben Oswald's work so much.
Like I said, it's very much a fan documentary. I'm glad to have all this information. And Edgar Wright keeps it moving. It's 2.5-hour documentary. And because he has this sort of list approach, you're engaged throughout. That's a good way to keep an audience engaged. I just wish that there had been a little bit more, I don't want to say objectivity, but just a little bit more about their story, about who they are. We get to know that some things about their personal lives, but not a lot. We're not really sure. Like, Jane Wiedlin was dating Russell for a little bit, and they talk about that, but that's as much as we get in terms of their personal lives, what their beliefs are, what they do when they're not writing music. When we catch up with them in the present day, the male brothers, and they're still writing music. We get the impression that they wake up, they go to the same cafe every morning, because they're very, very fond of ritual. Mm. They meet at their music studio, and they just write music all day. Just these two brothers, that they've been doing this ever since they were in college.
I feel like that's, like, going to be like you and me when we're 80. Yeah, we'll still be making podcasts, just getting up every morning, you know, saying, you know, saluting our robot overlords.
And then going back. How was the croissant today? Oh, it was a good croissant today. Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, well, it sounds okay. Well,
it's pretty good, but okay. Yeah, I was longing for more. I was longing for something. Fair. There's a bit near the end. Just one last thing. There's a bit near the end where Sparks decided to take on this really massive live performance project, where over the course of 25 nights, they were going to perform every single one of their songs. That's like 800 some songs, and from all 25 of their records in chronological order. And they talked about what a difficult task that was, and I wish that had been sort of the framing device, like how difficult that was. How did they feel on night 24 of this thing? You know, was it a relief? How difficult was it? And then maybe through that context, they could flash back to each of their records and talk about the making of each one. Some of the records weren't hits; they don't talk about those records for very long. I want to hear more about their failures, but that's just because I'm a twisted fuck.
You live for a documentary. You want to hear about all of it, don't you? You don't necessarily have to get into, like, the worst. What's the worst thing you've ever done, Sparks? One time I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. Like, no, tell us about how it was hard to make that album once. All right, well, fair enough. Listen, let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Once again, if you're new or just need a reminder, the critically acclaimed scale goes thusly. We review films on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest you can get is a C+. That's below average. We generally don't recommend it if it's I did that wrong. C-. C- is as low as it's the exact opposite. C- is as low as it can get. Okay, that's below average. That means we don't really recommend it. A C is average. Most movies are average. Some good, some bad. You know, maybe it's up your alley, maybe it's not. And then C+ is really quite good, and we definitely recommend the film. So let's get going. The Sparks Brothers, Whitney, on the critically acclaimed scale.
It's a really high C, or I'm going to give it a low C+.
Okay.
Just because it is really informative, and Sparks is a really interesting band. But like I said, I wish Edgar Wright had brought a little bit broader of a view of the band than just how great they are.
Fair enough. False positive.
A high C.
Okay.
It can go a little bit further, but I think it has something on its mind, and I appreciate that.
An unquiet grave. I will give this high C.
All right.
I think it handles its themes really, really well, but it's kind of undermined by how slight it feels. Yeah. But again, as low budget horror filmmaking goes, like I could teach this in a class, just in terms of, like, here's how you get a lot out of a little. Mm. They could have done a little bit more, and it would have been for the movie's benefit, but I did like it. The Evil Next Door.
The Evil Next Door, C-. It's just, I've already forgotten it, and I saw it yesterday.
All right. I Carry You With Me.
A C.
Okay.
A C. It's, you know, very, like I said, it's emotionally disarming. I like that, that it just sort of, you carry it with you, don't you?
Yeah. Lansky.
Lansky C-. Mm. Yeah, it's a big missed opportunity in many, many ways.
Yeah, it would have been so nice to give Harvey Keitel this, like, wonderful gift of an interesting character, great performance, and the movie just really lets him down. Mm. Damn shame. Werewolves Within, on the other hand, big ol' C+.
C+ for me, too.
It might be the best movie I've seen this year, but it's one of my favorites. Like, I just had a really good time with it.
It's just so enjoyable. It's just such a light, engaging movie.
Yeah, just definite hearty recommendation. Get out on the ground floor with this cult. I recommend that. Tell people, let's get this thing going. Let's get this movie popular within, like, a couple of years rather than 10.
Yeah.
And then lastly, which I didn't see, F9.
F9 is...
Be honest.
It's an F. For fast. It's an FF. It's a C+. Sure, why not? It's difficult because this is a really stupid movie.
Right.
It's a stupid movie.
But it goes
it's a
back,
really stupid
does it,
movie.
Does it go back around to being smart about how stupid it is?
It doesn't go around to being smart, but good golly, is it entertaining. And I can't deny that I was, you know, just clapping my little hands, having a great time when they're launching cars into space and shit.
I guess the lesson is, if you're going to be a stupid action movie, don't do it by halves.
Yeah.
Like,
just
go for it.
Go for full stupid, you know, be completely earnest about it. Don't assume I'm going to care. Just assume I'm going to have thrills, and that's all I really want. Awesome. That's all I really want is thrills.
All right, well, that is it for the Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with reviews of films like The Forever Purge and others. Other stuff's coming out, right? I don't know.
Isn't Black Widow next week, or is it
the
week after?
That's next week. This week is Forever Purge.
All right.
Like, Black Widow's like the 10th or something, or 9th.
9th or 10th. Oh, yeah.
So we got stuff. We'll be back. So that'll be soon. Thank you everybody for listening. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, take us to task for something, raise a salient point, or just talk about anything else you want us to discuss, you can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net, and we might read your email in an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. Mm-hmm. Whitney, how can they contact us if they want to do so on paper?
We do have a P.O. box. Isn't that keen? If you want to mail us an actual physical letter, we'll read that one as well. You can mail us. Just mail us at the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565. Los Angeles, California, 90064. That's P.O. Box 641565. Say it with me.
Never.
641.
641.
565.
565.
Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah.
Got it.
We got a postcard. We've gotten some kind things from people already.
Appreciate it. Again, no pressure, nothing, but some people wanted the option. Mm. And of course, we're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimed. Network, where we have a lot of exclusive shows, including shows about Batman, Star Trek, our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays. We review every single episode of Star Trek in order, and we just got through the live action original series, the animated series, and we just put out an episode about Star Trek the Motion Picture, which my opinions of have changed dramatically since rewatching it. So that was an interesting conversation to have, and I hope you're enjoying that. And then pretty soon we're going to be moving on to The Next Generation, and we have a lot of stuff there as well. Very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show and all of our other shows would not be possible. If you can afford to be a patron, we would love to have you. And if you can't and you want to help out the show, leave us a review, leave us a star rating wherever you find the podcast. That really, really helps. Seriously, that helps like a lot. I guess that's it. So thank you everybody for listening, and never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?